From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition. Thank you so much for being here with us this evening. I'm your host, Jason Dole. But not for long. I'm about to hand things over to Bill Williams, because it's time once again for the Kingfisher Project, Information Against Addiction, only here on Radio Catskill's Local Edition.
Welcome to the Kingfisher Project, information and awareness about the heroin and opiate epidemic. I'm Julie Pizzol. The Kingfisher Project began in memory of my daughter, Rebecca Jean Pizzol, who was shot and killed due to her heroin addiction. At her memorial service, her former teacher, Mr. Okazalik, read an essay she wrote. It was about a bird, an injured kingfisher bird that she found and rescued when everyone else had given up on the bird. In that spirit, our community came together and formed the Kingfisher Project. Since 2014, we have been raising awareness about the drug and opiate crisis in our listening area and around the country, right here on Radio Catskill. Here is Bill Williams.
My guest is Richard J. Baum. Richard is an adjunct professor of public policy at Georgetown University, a career civil servant until late 2025. He spent 35 years working on our country's drug problem. 28 of those years were with the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy across six presidential administrations. From 2017 to 2018, he served as the acting director of ONDCP, also known as the U.S. Drug Czar. He served as executive director of the President's Opioid Commission from 2017 to 2018. He joins us today to talk about his new book, Inside America's Opioid Crisis, 12 Hard Lessons for Today's Drug War. Welcome, Richard.
Great to be here, Bill.
I noticed that the book is bookended. In the very first chapter, you talk about stigma. And as you conclude, you talk about stigma again. And actually, in different places throughout the book, you talk about stigma. That seems to be a recurring theme and the biggest obstacle we face.
Well, I think it's woven throughout the book, because it's woven throughout the reality of addressing the very complicated and serious drug problem that the country faces. And to me, the most important question in all of drug policy is, how do we get more people to voluntarily come forward to initiate some level of treatment? Because as I think you and many of your listeners know, most of the people with a substance use disorder, alcohol or drugs, clearly more than three quarters, are not seeking treatment. They need treatment, but they're not seeking treatment. And there are a number of reasons for that. But the stigma that they've experienced in their lives and in their daily struggles serve as a deterrent for them taking those steps into a drug treatment program. So I'm a big believer in trying to find ways to reach out to people. And, you know, it's a simple question, but if you want people to do something, you ought to talk to them about how they want to receive help, where they want to receive help, what type of help you want to receive. You know, it's no problem if people are knocking down the door. But if you are part of a system that is not meeting the needs of 75-85% of the people who need help, you should be talking to them about strategies and tactics at work. And I think that starts in treating people with respect, with understanding. It doesn't end with that, but you have to start there. So to me, stigma is a focus of my book, because I think it's an underappreciated reality. The system has to grapple with it. There need to be changes in policies and programs across the country.
It seems to me there are two points of entry where people show up. One is in the criminal justice system, when they face arrest or they've been engaged by law enforcement, and the other is in the emergency departments of hospitals. And that we don't do enough. You talk about knocking on the door. These are people that have maybe been brought through the door. They've arrived at the door, but the ability to greet them on the other end is insufficient.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think this is an important thing about policy in the country. There are great programs in hospitals. and there are great programs in the justice system. They're just not anywhere near to the scale that's necessary. That's sort of the theme of my book. If you're looking for a program in the hospital, I know Vanderbilt in Tennessee has a great program. And there are 4,000 drug courts in the country. There are a lot of police facilitated deflection programs, but they're just not everywhere. And actually, in a way, it's really frustrating because on the one hand, when you see a program that works, when you're getting somebody smoothly transitioned from a non-fatal overdose, first to the care of a hospital emergency department, and then directly into initiating treatment. It's so exciting to see that happen, but we're not able to get that to everyone. And there are multiple reasons why, but I think the biggest reason is resources. And there's not enough funds to do all these things, and it's a very competitive environment. So that's why I'm calling for a 20% increase in the drug budget to help fill these gaps.
You, as an adjunct professor, do you use this book as a textbook for your course?
Yes, I certainly require my students to read it, and they tell me they enjoy it.
Well, I enjoyed it when I read it. It's. I was just talking to a friend the other night who's read it as well. You're actually, I believe, going to do an interview with Lisa Poggi.
Yes.
And we both use the same word. It's dense, and that's not a criticism. That's a compliment. There's an awful lot to absorb in the book. You've really packed 300 pages very full.
I have, because really the purpose of my book is to pass to this next generation of drug policymakers, of prevention, treatment, recovery, law enforcement, international, whose career and daily work is either firmly in the drug policy realm or adjacent to it, my own lessons that I try to, and I think I hopefully succeeded in humbly saying, hey, I had a lot to learn. I've been doing this a long time. I had things wrong in my head. I made mistakes, but I've learned a lot. Especially that year I was director, because you get to travel around and go into the very best programs in the country, treatment centers, jails, prison recovery programs, drug courts, mental health courts. And I just wanted to put it all in writing to help those who are on their own learning curve to maybe move along faster. So yes, it's packed full, but it also does have some anecdotes and introductions and a lot of headings and descriptions and summaries to try and make it useful and easy to read for the expert and the non-expert. But yep, I've learned a lot. I packed it in there, and I want to pay it forward to readers.
Well, you've done it for this reader. One of the things you proposed, I'm just going to read it. Generate $10 billion via an opioid crisis fee on the pharmaceutical industry. And I noticed you generate $10 billion that way. And when you took the list of your recommendations and you added up the cost for what you recommended would be $10 billion. I presume it's no accident those two figures are the same.
No, just as an author, I felt it was my responsibility to propose an idea on how to fund it. I mean, I was a congressional staffer. I know that initiatives and ideas aren't always associated with how you're going to pay for it. But I just felt it was rather to say, hey, the country should borrow the money to pay for this, to come forward with my ideas, with an idea. You know, the pharmaceutical industry does some great things, but they also contributed to the development of the opioid crisis. It's a $500 billion industry or so. And I felt like that's one way to generate resources to fund it. And just for your listeners, Bill, and I know this is a very Washington thing, but you know, we look at the total drug budget, and these are big numbers. So $10 billion, of course, absolutely sounds like a ton of money, and it's a good chunk of money, but the drug budget is already about $45 billion. So I'm looking at the total, and I'm proposing a 20% increase in what we're already spending, which I felt was a credible number, achievable number. And if you look at, say, how much we increased spending when we dealt with the COVID crisis and other national crises, how much we're spending at war, it seems to me a fair number. There's also an issue of an absorption capacity when you expand programs like I proposed. But I believe that 20% increase could make a real difference if used correctly per some of the ideas I propose.
One of the things you talk about in the book is the return on investment. So this is money. This is not all money that's wasted, because if we make that investment, it pays dividends down the line and for a long time and in other ways, correct?
Yeah, I think that there are a couple ideas I'm trying to get across. And one is, as much as I, like you, like many of your listeners, are so committed to doing everything we can to save people who are impacted by drug use, we're not doing it to make us feel good. We're doing it to make a difference, to produce a return. And so I'm a strong believer in research and a scrutiny of programs, of working to continuously improve interventions as results from research comes in. And to, if programs don't work after, you know, sincere efforts to fix them, then let's put the money somewhere else. I think that, you know, in Washington, the budget fight is every year. And it's pretty rough and vicious to fight for resources. So what I was trying to do is to lay out both the justification for more federal tax dollars in some way or another going to fight drugs, and then explain how to make sure that benefit pays off. But, you know, just to say it more plainly, earlier interventions, treatment interventions, prevention, recovery support, they save money over time. You know, it's a lot cheaper to give somebody treatment earlier in their addiction rather than deal with the criminal justice cost and the treatment cost, and not to mention the cost to the family. So all along, early intervention and sustained support for people with a history of drug use.
And you spend a lot of time talking about people that have been incarcerated and what we need to do to support them, both during their incarceration and upon their release.
Yeah. You know, when someone goes to jail or prison, they have a debt to pay to society. And it's fair when someone has a sentence for a crime, and if there was a victim, of course, there are consequences to actions. But most of the people arrested for drug-related crimes, I mean crimes related to supporting someone's drug use, robbery, fraud, almost all those people are going to be out again, right? They're not locked up forever. Most of them didn't commit murder. So what supports public safety? What supports public safety is when they're out, when they pay their debt to society, that they don't recidivate, they don't commit new crimes, they don't go back to drug use, and they can rebuild their lives. But in most places in the country, there is rather minimal support that people leave prison with a history of drug use. You know, and about, I would say, two-thirds of people leaving prison have some type of history with drug use, many who had a substance use disorder or other problematic drug use. So why do we spend $40,000, $50,000 a year to keep someone behind bars with the goal of promoting public safety and not spend $1,000 or $2,000 in those weeks and month or so when they get out, so they're not on the street, so they can find a place to live and food to eat and begin to rebuild their lives? And the rate of overdose from people that are reentering from jail and prison is unbelievably high. And I think you'd understand that people who may return to use after all those years of behind bars, when they have no control over what they do, they're in a very strict environment, that all of a sudden they're out again. Many are tempted to buy drugs and use drugs again. They buy what's on the street today, and because they haven't been using these drugs for years, even if they got intermittent drug use in prison, it's not a daily phenomenon, they're very likely to overdose, and many die. And, you know, have you served your sentence a few years, you committed a crime, And it shouldn't be a death sentence. And in many cases, we're allowing it to be a death sentence by not supporting people when they return from jail.
You're listening to the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition. I'm your host, Bill Williams. After the break, more with Richard Baum.
You're listening to the Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
The numbers are classified, but the best estimates from our sources inside the military are that they have somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,700 Patriot systems left in the whole global arsenal. And that's after the U.S. has burned through about 1,500 of these.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Wherever you go, take Radio Catskill with you. Stream your favorite shows, music, and podcasts anytime, anywhere with our new and improved app. Stay connected with local news and national headlines all in one place. You can even send us your thoughts with the Talk to Us feature, audio or video, right from your phone. No radio? No problem. Just press play. It's Radio Catskill right in your pocket. Download the app today on iPhone or Android.
Welcome back to the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition. I'm your host, Bill Williams, and I'm talking with Richard Baum, author of the newly published Inside America's Opioid Crisis, 12 Hard Lessons for Today's Drug War. If we save these lives and get people housing and find them work, they become taxpayers and we've got a return on the investment.
Right. And they're not committing crimes which accrue new criminal justice costs. So we're really hurting ourselves in terms of the costs because, you know, and we need to find a way as a country to hold the people who manage and run jails and prisons to what happens after. I mean, they have a job to do, right? Their job is to protect public safety. So when someone is their responsibility and they release them not prepared to live, they're not doing a good job, right? I think their salary, their bonuses, their performance evaluations should relate to not just what happens while they're behind bars, but when they leave their care, when they, you know, that we should ask the question, have they done what they needed to do to set people up for success, or are they just warehousing people? Because warehousing people doesn't support public safety.
Do you have an example of a jail or prison system that actually does a good job that could be a potential model?
Yes. You know, there are, there's a program in Virginia, in a suburb of Richmond, that they have a sort of a version of a therapeutic community that's updated for the opioid crisis. They have pods of men and women who live together, and they work through an addiction treatment program. And when they leave, they have a Facebook page where they stay in touch and support each other. And if you're outside jail or prison and you're struggling a bit, the warden, the sheriff, lets them back into the jail to see some of the same counselors and their fellow inmates who are still there and the staff. And that is a great tribute to this one jail. But it also is a reminder that we haven't built out this recovery network outside jail, because what we really want is people to be connected to resources, recovery community organizations, and opportunities for paid work, continuing treatment and recovery assistance. We need to transition people properly. And, you know, it isn't that complicated, right? Someone leaves prison and leaves jail. It isn't complicated in concept. Is you want to start some type of treatment in jail and prison, especially in those last few months, and you want to transition them to programming and support outside jail and prison. You want them to have a place to live, food to eat, paid work, a connection to a community, a faith community, a new group of friends, so they're not alone in trying to find their footing. And so we know all this, but we're just not making it happen at the federal and state level at scale.
You mentioned this is in Richmond, Virginia. Is there any connection between this program and the McShin Foundation?
Actually, yes. The McShin Foundation did advise that group.
Because one of my prior guests was Carol McDade, who's involved with the McShin Foundation, and I'm sure you know her from her lobbying work, too.
I do. So this is what I think this example we really need to focus on, because there are models. There are very good programs in almost anything, but there are the resources focused to assist that at scale. And that's why a lot of my book is focused on, you know, defining the problem, explaining the problem, but really a bit from a sort of a public administration, public service point of view, is how do we take what we know and what we've learned and actually propose something in Congress or in state legislatures to deliver these results? Because it's something that's in our power to do. You know, if we have the will to invest and spread effective programs adapted to the local conditions, there are a lot more people who can and would be helped.
Let me be clear for our listeners. I don't think you're talking about the federal government running all these programs. You're talking about how the federal government can support things that work.
Right, through grant programs. It's a really interesting point, sort of a public administration point. But most of the treatment, recovery, and prevention funds that people see in their states, cities, and towns is funded through federal government grants. And it's a bit confusing because when I traveled around when I was acting drug czar, I would meet with governors. And they would tell me about the drug programs running out of their offices, and they would be good programs and promising programs. And I always asked, how are these programs funded? And they said, oh, through Health and Human Services grants and programs. So we have, you could argue whether this is the way it should be or shouldn't be, but the way it is, and it is we federalized most drug programs. So there are these large grant programs run through SAMHSA, Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, and there are smaller grant programs at the CDC, Office of Justice Programs, ONDCP has some, Office of National Drug Control Policy. And so that is the way I would propose expanding the use of model programs all across the country.
In your book, you make 32 recommendations. Any priorities? Where would you start? I'm assuming that trying to tackle all 32 at once is impossible.
Well, I tell you, as a country, if we really looked at what's happened in the opioid crisis, especially since 2013, when fentanyl started killing Americans at a very terrifying and rapid rate, and is still a major contributor to overdose deaths. 70,000 Americans still dying every year from overdose. A lot of that is fentanyl, also involving stimulants and sedatives. That's a lot of people. But, if I would emphasize one, I'm a big believer in recovery coaches and peer support. And I've called for the federal government to train and hire 100,000 new recovery coaches and peers over the next 10 years. And there are a couple of reasons why I think that's a critical recommendation. Going back to the earlier part of our discussion about low treatment entry, it's recovery coaches and peers, those who have their own lived experience, that are really able to be an incredible facilitator between the opportunities for treatment and care and self-protection, disease prevention, and the system and the health system. Because many people who have years of active drug use, they have a loss of trust in the system, in the health system. Many have been through treatment programs that where they've been re-traumatized and not treated kindly and been in the justice system. And a peer or recovery coach really breaks down that walls and can build rapport and help guide and support someone into the treatment and care that they're ready for. Also, we need to scale up our system. We need to scale up mobile care and outreach and recovery coaches and peers in the ideal front line. There are also, you know, I support having more addiction counselors and more doctors and social workers. All those professionals do amazing work. But recovery coaches are the least are less expensive. And there's 40 hours of training to get started, and then people learn on the job. And also, you know, you mentioned earlier in your question about things that we could do in jail. And I do support a medications treatment be available in jail. But another thing we could do is people can get virtual training. Inmates who are in stable recovery themselves can get a virtual training on how to be a recovery coach behind bars, help their fellow inmates, and then have a really valuable job skill they could put to work when they get out. So I think that'd be a good investment. And those of you like me who remember the Clinton administration and his commitment to fund 100,000 community police officers, I'm sort of stealing that idea and applying it to recovery coaches, because I think they can make a real difference in the country.
Where would we find 100,000 people?
Uh-oh. Well, we have I think 70 million Americans in recovery. So I think it wouldn't be hard if there's a recruitment program. There are a lot of people who have the lived experience and who would be great at these jobs if given a chance.
Do you have any final thoughts?
I would just say that on the one hand, we do face a tremendous challenge in the country, and we live in a dangerous world with drugs. But there also are these great initiatives that have been developed through the innovations of people, great people in the community around the country, and they've shown success. And we don't have to reinvent the wheel, but what we do have to do is figure out a way to fund and support effective programs so that people who need addiction treatment want to enter those programs, they get ongoing care of adequate quality and duration, that we divert people into drug courts instead of prison and deflect people before arrest. Police are doing some amazing work in a lot of our communities in trying to help people get into treatment. And it's not compulsory, right? In a drug court or a deflection program, it's some leverage. People choose. So we have these great programs. People shouldn't be discouraged, but we do have to invest in them. We have to invest and pay for quality care. Everybody needs access to quality prevention treatment programs. So we need to find a way, and we can definitely afford it. A 20% increase in the drug budget isn't that much. And there are ways to finance it, and it has a return on investment. These programs will be invested by people. They pay off and reduce costs down the road.
Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Bill. I've been talking with Richard Baum, author of the newly published Inside America's Opioid Crisis, 12 Hard Lessons for Today's Drugs. Richard, thank you.
And Bill, if I'd love people to buy the book, but I also have free resources on my website at richardjbaum.com. I have short videos, I have information and some highlights from my book. So if you want to just check that out and put your toe in, that's a low-cost way of checking it out.
Give us the website again, please.
richardjbaum.com.
Terrific. Thank you.
Big thanks to Bill Williams for doing the Kingfisher Project. Thank you for listening. Do keep on listening on air. Always live streaming at WJFFradio.org is where you can go to hear the rest of that conversation on the Kingfisher podcast. This has been the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. I'll be back tomorrow evening to do it all over again. Coming up at 7, we've got Music Emporium with Mr. Kusar Grace. But first, it's The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
If you've got an amazing record collection, but you also need to downsize, why not give it to Radio Catskill? We're always taking donations of clean vinyl in good condition for our music sale. Donate today at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.